So I was thinking about Easter this morning, and a lot of you either are planning to or have already had some type of Easter egg hunt with your kids, especially if you have kids. So, oh, and by the way, as we get started in this, now would be a great time if you're doing your offering to do that. As you've seen before, we have lots of ways to do that through the app, online. I know a lot of you are asking still how to give, and whether it's sending in checks or doing it electronically. We'd love to see you continue to support the work of God to the church and through the things that God is doing. So feel free to do that. But as we think about that, and as we're doing all these things and thinking about Easter, I want to take you back to when you maybe did one of those Easter egg hunts when your kids were really little. You know, those first couple when they can barely walk, they're maybe 2 years old. Do you remember what those look like? I find them utterly fascinating, of course, having grandkids now and being able to watch them do that. It's kind of funny because you get different responses. One child, you tell them to go look for eggs, and they find one egg and they think they're done. So they're like, hey, I found an egg, and they're ready to go back in the house and play. And it takes the parents to say, no, look for some more, look for some more. There's more there. You know, they're kind of encouraging them on. And then you have the child who decides that every egg he sees is his. And so he's knocking over children. He's taking all the eggs from everybody, and you have to slow them down. Like, stop, you know, leave some for other people. And then you have the odd one who's just so overwhelmed by the whole thing. They stand in the middle of the yard and they begin to cry, and it's supposed to be happy and everybody's taking pictures, and they're just wailing, and it's really quite endearing. But you remember, and of course, as you get older, then you got to get more creative and you got to start putting the things. I remember the year we actually had to hide Easter treats in the dryer because the kids would find them everywhere else, and you get more creative. But I thought about that and I said, you know what? What makes that fun? What makes that enjoyable? Is really the joy of kind of holding things up in front of the kids. So it's like, you all know this, right? So you have your egg and you say, all right, kids, you're looking for this. And inside this, there's chocolate, there's candy. And the kids' eyes get all big and they're excited. And you say, you know, and then these ones have gummy worms. And then you'll tell them, hey, and if you find the golden egg, that has a big prize. And so the kids are all excited and, you know, they go off and they do their thing. And I thought, you know, I don't think that ever changes as we get older. We love being the bearer of good news because of the reaction it evokes. Now, news of any type evokes reaction because negative news can do the same thing. But it got me thinking this morning, how did Jesus look at all this on Easter Sunday? And I wonder if he had a sense of fatherly delight as he was breaking this unexpected good news to the people around him. So we're going to take a look at this because I think there's some very interesting things about this news and how Jesus operated. I want to read out of Matthew chapter 28. The news of Jesus' resurrection is recorded in all four accounts. All four Gospels have it written in it. But we're going to look at Matthew 28 this morning and his account. And we're going to start right at verse 1. So I'm going to put it up on the screen if you want to follow along. And it says, after the Sabbath, so after Saturday, on Sunday morning, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, and going to the tomb, he rolled back the stone and he sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid. For I know that you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He's not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples." And this is where I wonder, like, what is going on here? And let me go back here. I'm not sure why it went back. Let me go back here. Let me go back to that slide. I think it's at this point that he's giving this news. I just wonder if there's like a twinkle in his eye or something, because he says, go quickly, tell the disciples he has risen from the dead. And he's going to go ahead of you into Galilee. All right. There you will see him. Now I have told you. And so the women, they hurry away from the tomb, and they're afraid, and they're filled with joy, and they run to tell the disciples. And it's as they're running to tell the disciples that Jesus himself, he meets them. And he says, "Greetings." And they fell to his feet and they worshiped him. And Jesus said, hey, don't be afraid. Hey, don't be afraid. Go tell my brothers in Galilee and there they will see me. And I wonder sometimes what Jesus was thinking and how he thought they'd respond. Almost like saying, hey, we talked about this for a long time. You don't have a clue what's going on, but I got some good news for you. See, I don't know what kind of Jesus you grew up with. The older I get, the more I realize the Jesus I know and the Jesus of the resurrection story and his life was not a passive Jesus. He was not a gentle Jesus who did nothing. He was a disturber. He was someone who challenged and caused people to react, both positively and negatively, because he interrupted the expectations and dreams of people. A lot of you have probably seen those pictures of Jesus, you know, holding a lamb, praying, usually with that glow around him, and all looks so serene and he looks so gentle. And I think sometimes we've come to this place where we've got a tame Jesus. And what I mean by that is a Jesus that we understand, a Jesus that's under control. I mean, he's in my corner. He's there to help me. He loves and he cares for me. He wants to sit beside me. He's nice. But here's the problem, and I notice this problem particularly in the middle of a situation like this with the pandemic, is that this creates an issue when life is not tame, when things are out of control, when life is chaotic and tumultuous and crazy and uncertain, and we start to get worried and fearful, or just it feels out of control. And the more I read the Easter story, the more I see that Jesus was exactly that. He was not a tame Jesus. He stirred things up. He challenged. He made people uncomfortable. He exercised power. He got excited. And he's still doing all those things today. He's stirring us up. He's disturbing our lives. He's challenging our dreams in the midst of this current pandemic that's nowhere more clear than right now. And he's not leaving us in a comfortable place. Now, this isn't because Jesus delights in our discomfort. He doesn't delight in causing problems. He doesn't delight in breaking our dreams or causing us to not have what we want. No, the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus is simply showing us this, that God wants to disturb our dreams to lead us into better ones. He wants to disturb and to shake up and to mess with all those wonderful dreams we have because he's got something better. See, when our dreams are broken or our expectations of God and life are not met, we have there's this whole variety of responses that happen. And what becomes apparent through this entire narrative at Easter is that everyone had a dream or a plan or some expectations that Jesus was messing up. He was disturbing. He was wrecking what they thought they wanted and what they believed was best. So let me take a look. There's some different groups of people here that react. But one thing you'll see common in all of these, and you'll probably identify with one or two of them, is that when Jesus doesn't help our dreams, when we have expectations and dreams, and when Jesus doesn't help them go the way we want them to, our tendency is to protect. We want to protect. We want to kind of round the wagons. We want to make sure that we get the things that we're dreaming. So as you look at the main players in the Easter story, you'll see four different responses to these broken expectations or dreams. So let's take a look at them. The first one, and the first response is to reject and betray Jesus. That was Judas. Judas is the first one kind of who comes to mind in this because he followed Jesus, just like the other disciples, for the better part of 3 years. He participated in all the stuff Jesus was doing. And we know from John that he was the treasurer of their little group. He managed the money. He used to skim off the top for himself. And like all the other disciples, he saw Jesus rise to prominence, and he saw it as an opportunity to get ahead. He wanted to make some money. He wanted to go in influence from here to here. And then all of a sudden, he has all these pictures in his head. Jesus begins to talk about dying. And this was not the talk of a Messiah. And the final straw came when a woman who came and she used this hugely expensive jar of perfume. She anoints Jesus. She breaks it. And not only did Jesus not rebuke her for what she did, he actually praised her because he said, she's preparing me for burial. These were not the words and actions of a Messiah. So Judas, he abandoned ship. He decided to salvage what he could for selling Jesus out for 30 pieces of silver. The second response that we have in this story is that they abandoned Jesus. This was the disciples, because the rest of the disciples were in the same boat as Judas. They had walked with Jesus, suffered with Jesus, been taught by Jesus, and they thought good things were coming. They thought that maybe, just maybe, Jesus was actually the Messiah, the Savior. And they had visions of influence, of sitting at his right hand and his left hand. They saw themselves doing good and being leaders of the people alongside of Jesus. But then, instead of acting like a conqueror and a Messiah, Jesus let kids sit in his lap. He touched lepers and prostitutes. He washed their feet at dinner. He consorted with sinners and non-Jews. I mean, these were not the words and actions of one who could help them reach their dreams. And when he finally allowed himself to be arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, we read, everyone left him and ran away. But there's a third response for people when their dreams were threatened, and it was to attack Jesus. These are the religious leaders. These are the people who kept the religion in Israel. These are actually very moral, very good people. They read and studied all the prophecies. They trusted God. They believed in God. They believed that God was actually going to bring Israel back to the prominence that he had promised. They believed he would send a Messiah. The problem was that their picture of that was like David, someone powerful in word and deed who would lead the nation back to independence. And so what would happen is they would investigate anybody who might be like that. So like when John the Baptist came, they thought, hey, maybe this is the guy. Maybe he's the Messiah. So they investigated, but he said, no, that's not me. And so when they heard about this rabbi who had crowds following and hanging on every word, who was doing these supernatural miracles, and the people were watching and following, they said, we got to investigate. But instead of being what they expected, he resisted every attempt they had to pigeonhole him. And instead of talking about throwing off the Romans, he preached about turning the other cheek. Instead of speaking words of power and authority, he said the meek and the humble were blessed. Instead of seeking out the religious elite and the knowledgeable, in other words, them, he had disciples who were nobodies, and he hung out with tax collectors and sinners and went to parties. These could not be the words or actions of a Messiah. And yet he was threatening their dreams, their hopes, and even their livelihoods. So they schemed, they plotted, they arrested Jesus, and they had him put to death. And then I see one more reaction from the story of how people responded when Jesus threatened dreams and expectations, and it was really to dismiss Jesus. This was the crowds. They dismissed him with skepticism, with scorn, because you have to understand that for a while, the people were all about Jesus. I mean, they'd never heard anybody speak like him. I mean, he had authority. They'd never encountered someone who could heal lame people and give sight back to the blind and bring people to life and cast out demons and calm storms and feed the multitudes with almost no bread. And they saw Jesus as the solution to all of their problems. His teachings made them feel good, even when he challenged them and they didn't understand them. He met their physical needs. And they thought, if this man would step up and declare himself to be king, his influence will grow, it would spread, and we'll be able to live lives of freedom with our families, having our needs met and our stomachs full. And then Jesus began to withdraw from the crowds. He didn't go or do what they wanted him to go and do. He told them that if they wanted to follow him, they had to deny themselves and sacrifice what was most important to them and pick up their cross and follow him. And they thought, wow, that's not the actions or words of someone who could give me what I want. And if he's not going to live up to my expectations, then we'll just see what we'll see. And we read that Pilate said, what should I do then with the one you call king of the Jews? Crucify him, the crowd shouted. Why? What wrong has he done? Asked Pilate. And they shouted even louder, crucify him. And so they did. And on Sunday morning, 2,000 years ago, I got to tell you, there was no hope. There was no expectation. All the dreams that people had for Jesus were dead. For some, it was a small dream lost that they just dismissed. For others, it was their whole life. And for some, it was their hopes had been dashed and they could go back to their real dreams, the ones they thought that it should be that way. You know, as I thought about that, I realized our responses really haven't changed today. I wonder, as you're watching this morning, what dreams do you have that have been shattered, postponed, or gone by the wayside? What do you wish that Jesus would do for you and your family and your friends that have not happened? Dreams for financial security that are being messed up by the current situation, or maybe they were messed up before this even started. Dreams for influence to make a difference. Dreams for stability in a family and in relationships. Maybe for just for a job that isn't miserable to go to every day. Or maybe to have a job. Maybe just to wake up feeling completely healthy once. Maybe to see your kids follow God with all their hearts. Maybe for your marriage to improve. Dreams just to be protected from the virus and everything that's going around. To have that vacation that had to be canceled that now you won't be able to get. To get out of depression. Or maybe to have someone you love get out of it. To have that person back that you beg God to keep alive. We hope, we wish, we pray, we ask, we expect. And when it isn't happening or it hasn't happening, how have we responded? How do you respond? Maybe respond like Jesus, where we say, you know what, Jesus, I'm going to take control of my life. God, he isn't helping me. So I'm going to help myself. I don't need him. I don't need church. I don't need religion. I'm going to do my best, get what I can, and make sure I look out for me and those around me, like Judas. Or maybe you're not like that. You haven't betrayed. You haven't walked away from God. But you've abandoned the church. You've abandoned all those things. You're sad about what you've lost. Your dreams have left you disillusioned, and you don't really trust God or his people any longer. And you think to yourself, you know, God, your words sound good, but I've been hurt. I've been disillusioned too often, and I'm just not sure I trust you anymore, like the disciples. Or maybe we've responded like the Pharisees. We've gotten angry, and we decide, you know what? If all this is going on, Jesus, you know, God, you just can't exist, and Jesus doesn't matter. The world is just simply too messed up, and it just proves there's no loving God. He obviously doesn't care about me, so I don't care about him. I wish he would just leave me alone. I wish other people would stop talking about it. It's a bunch of fairy tales who need something to believe in. I know it's true, and that's not it. Or maybe your broken dreams have left you in a permanent land of skepticism and scorn, and you can't understand those believe, even though you wish that you could. And you think, I'm just living the best I can, and I don't want to upset my own dreams enough to rely on someone that I'm not sure who's there or even cares. See, this is where all the followers of Jesus were. And then Sunday morning happened, and it all changed. You see, when our dreams, many of which are really good dreams, great dreams even, do not happen, or they're damaged or lost, our tendency is to hunker down, to protect, to make sure that things go good, because we hate being disappointed. We hate being frustrated. But let me remind you, God disturbs our dreams to lead us into better ones. And there's a reason for that, and it's simply this. God's dreams are bigger and better. See, that Sunday morning so long ago, none of the people, not even those who are closest to him, believed that Jesus had a bigger plan. No one believed he was going to be alive again. No one believed that the end result, this was going to be good. There was no one waiting at the tomb and doing a countdown like 10, 9, 8, here he comes, he's going to rise from the dead. Nobody did that. They weren't waiting for him to come back. They were sorrowful, they were scared, they were confused. And then Jesus rose from the dead. The only one to have ever come back from the dead to live forever. So far. And he appeared to some women first, then to some traveling disciples, then to the rest of the disciples, then to Thomas, who missed him the first time, and then to more and more people. And he did this because they were so broken and disillusioned, it took all of those appearances to come to grips with the fact that he was alive. And it's funny because Jesus chided them for their unbelief, but he was gracious enough to meet them where they were. And he said, "Trust me. I've been telling you, there's a plan, and it's bigger, and it's more amazing, and in scope than anything you could have ever imagined. All those dreams you had, yeah, they were good. This is so much better. And my death and resurrection changed the history of our planet. And it opened up a way so that you could know God personally, and it gave you the opportunity to be assured of heaven. It opened up the way for you to have me walk with you in every circumstance in life and to experience joy and healing and blessing. You know, the followers of Jesus had no reference for this better dream. There was nothing that could prepare them for this. It's like when you go to Disney World for the first time and you try and tell your six-year-old or your seven-year-old or your eight-year-old, here's what Disney's like. And you can tell them, you can explain, you can tell how amazed it's going to be and how happy they're going to be. You can show them videos, you can show them the castle, you can show them the trip that you went when you were younger, and you can tell them all this stuff. And it isn't till you see them walk through the gate and look down Main Street USA and you see their eyes get wide and they're overwhelmed because they had no idea it was going to be this good. Jesus wants to disturb our dreams because he's got bigger ones that we can't even comprehend. And the resurrection of Jesus from the dead is the ultimate hope. Hope that while we might not always have the answers for why things go the way they do and why our dreams aren't going the way they should in life, hope that even when we don't know the reason why this pandemic's going on and why we've lost my job or all the issues, hope that when I look at this life and how it goes, Jesus has a plan that's bigger and better, that he is working, that he understands, that he feels, that he not only gets you, but he is wholly and fully invested in you. God disturbs our dreams to lead us into better ones. You may not see it. You may not understand it. It might feel like Saturday or Sunday morning of that first Easter, but God proved his trustworthiness in allowing his own son to die in your place, to suffer excruciatingly so that you and I get to participate in his kingdom. So this morning, Easter Sunday, as you go into your day and you celebrate with your family, his invitation this morning to you is to believe. And not believe just that he exists or that Jesus lived or even that the events of the Bible are true. No, no, no. It's so much bigger than that. To believe that he has a plan, that he's inviting you in to lean in, to trust him, to believe him enough to behave, to act, and to speak as though it's true even when you don't see it. Let God disturb your current dreams because he's leading you into some better ones. Jesus' best friend, John, he wrote it this way in John 20, but these are written that you may believe. In other words, all these things he's written, all this stuff we read about Jesus have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, trusting, following, leaning into him, you may have life in his name. May the resurrection of Jesus spur you to trust him and to have life.